Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borag Thunga, Thlitz, and welcome to the latest episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast, Lockdown Tapes. I am your host, as always, Molchar. And on this episode, we have the returning Rob Williams to talk about Judge Dredd End of Days, which is the collection that's out now from 2000 AD, which is last summer's big sort of mini-epic event that sees Dredd take on the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse with some fantastic artwork from Colin McNeil and Henry Flynn. So it was great to be able to get Rob onto the podcast again to talk about that. We also then start rambling about the ABC Warriors and do a little deep dive onto those early stories inspired by the Titan reprints from back in the 1980s. So yeah, it was great to have a bit of a chinwag about that. So without much further ado, we're going to crack on with that. Do head along to 2000ad.com/news for the latest news announcements, etc. from us. Yeah, let's hear from Rob Williams about Judge Dredd End of Days. Let's talk about End of Days, which is out in collection. When this airs, it will have been last week.
Okay.
Because you came on the podcast at the time to talk about the series, I seem to recall. Or was it might have been when we were talking about Control. I can't remember. Mm. Do you want to talk a little bit about the where End of Days comes from, because we the nature of the mega epic has changed quite significantly, certainly since Doomsday, the Doomsday scenario, and Doomsday for Dredd and Doomsday for Mega City One, and John Wagner has done his thing with things like Origins, things like Day of Chaos. But you and also Michael Carroll have done some work which has changed. A big story doesn't necessarily have to be the end of the world. But with this one, you kind of specifically gone for that big apocalyptic action. Tell us a bit about the origins of End of Days.
Before we do that, what constitutes a mega epic? I saw it written about this or something, and saying, it's a latest Dredd mega epic. And you kind of go, is there a requisite number of episodes you have to do for it to be a mega epic? You tell me.
Well, but this is the thing. There was a new blog that someone on the 2080 forum set up when they went through their top however many epics. And the first thing they had to do was define that. And when you start saying that something has to be a certain length in order to be an epic, then lots of stories you wouldn't normally consider to be an epic start coming into contention. Mm. Off the top of my head, something like, is Mandroid a mega epic? Mm. Do you include things from the magazine that go beyond a certain, but it has to naturally be quite an elastic concept. How would you define a mega epic?
I guess the stakes have got to be fairly big, right? Mm-hmm. And it's got to be a certain length. You can't have a mega epic as three episodes long. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it still feels maybe sort of it's the mega epics feel like the big classic ones that John did, and that we grew up like with Apocalypse War and Judge Child and things like that. So, I don't know. Even then, I guess even Chaos Day felt like, I'm sure it'd be easy to call it a mega epic, but it's that felt more like a slow kind of churn of Dredd, not Judge Dredd, Dredd, D-R-E-A-D, you know, rather than like a mega epic almost feels like there's a journey involved, whether that's true or not, I don't know, you know. And that was Chaos Day, for instance, was just staying at home and sort of misery upon misery as millions died. So I don't know. It's very fluid, but I guess it's just one of those terms that gets banded around with Dredd very easily with longer stories.
Well, I say everybody is one of those things that everybody knows what it means until they have to quantify it, and then it does kind of fall apart a little bit.
But it's like Small House was 8 episodes, I think, you know. But it was nice that it was a trade, but it was never the intention to kind of for that to be, oh, I'm writing a mega epic. I just felt like 8 episodes was probably about right. I mean, End of Days, for good or for ill, frankly, it felt like I could have kept writing that for quite some time. It could have kept going because it was by the nature of its sort of what it was meant to be going out was like just a road trip, effectively, an apocalyptic road trip. And there was a sense of journey, and it was sort of thinking about, oh, there's something in the sort of ilk of the Judge Child, you know, which was there is a quest and there are sort of beats to hit and MacGuffins to hit along the way. And, you know, but ultimately it was just a bunch of, you know, part of the fun of it was one of those stories where you stick a team in a ship with Dredd and you send them off, like just like Judge Child. So I think it was Judge Child was what I was kind of loosely kind of reaching for when I started it.
Because that is a story which, you know, whenever people think of mega epics, they think of things like The Cursed Earth. And absolutely, you know, The Judge Child is epic, but it belongs to that kind of old school epic, as you say, that episodic, you know, almost kind of Monster of the Week style thing where it eventually, there's an overarching narrative, but you kind of
It'll come home eventually, but I think, I mean, that's what it felt like. There was just stops along the way, and those stops are very, really varied, you know what I mean? And I wasn't there. I couldn't speak for the people involved, but I imagine the general idea was let's send Dredd off into space, basically, and he can have some adventures. This is a little bit similar in that regard, you know. And for whatever reason, we settled on, I think it was 15 episodes with End of Days. But yeah, I mean, that when you set out on writing something of that length, you do initially think, oh, I've got loads of room, and then you kind of feel like I could easily keep, because you could do it. I mean, you could even bring on other writers and just have gone like have someone else have it for 4 weeks or something. And there's a MacGuffin over there, an adventure over there, you know. But the overall story came from, it was born out of the idea, really. I just got this idea in my head of Ichabod Azrael riding, at midnight, a biblical rider, you know, riding at some Megacity One with a warning that the end of the world was here, you know. And just the fact that you had a character who belonged in this entirely other story, entirely other world and timeline was here. That just got me excited. And that was just sort of spoke towards the fact that, you know, the walls of reality are coming down. So we're all really in trouble now. Everything's, you know, this is it. Just the fact that, and it got, you know, whether or not anyone else would be excited by that, I don't know. But to me, that actually, and then you can do that biblical Western thing, you know, which I kind of quite enjoy.
Did you have any worries about bringing in Ichabod? Because by this point, Ichabod Azrael, The Grievous Journey of Ichabod Azrael and Dead Left in His Wake, thanks very much for that title, had been gone, collection had been out for some time. Was there ever a point where you were like, this be a bit?
No, I did. I mean, it was one of those ones where, like, you know, again, for good or ill, I didn't really care if it was a bad idea or not. It was just, it got me excited, because I always liked Ichabod and I liked where we left it. I never really thought, oh, I'll bring him back one day. There was never that. It was just purely a weird idea that just, and I thought him and Dredd together would be quite a cool partnership, actually. It would be a quite a fun little teaming up on this adventure. So, and that sort of spoke to a lot of different weird creative possibilities. And I think as End of Days continues, it does go a bit cosmic and a bit timey-wimey. And we start pushing characters in ways that, you know, barriers of characters, I think, in a way that is a little unusual, which again was kind of exciting. I mean, Anderson and Dredd are, you know, even physically, Dredd, the whole sort of basis of the story is the fact that the four horsemen of the apocalypse have come and, you know, Dredd has to go and find them and kill them effectively. And the first one they come across is famine. And during that encounter, Dredd and Anderson are both, they suffer terrible sort of, you know, effects of, you know, encountering famine. So they look really thin and sort of emaciated. And Henry Flint, who drew, you know, sort of stuck with that all the way through, which I thought was terrific. You know, it was great. I mean, it was just a different kind of look. And then again, as we went on, sort of there's a character in it who is a, without giving too many spoilers away, is a severed angel's head. And he's constantly sort of nagging on Anderson. He wants Anderson's powers to do a deal with him, which is kind of like a Faustian pact. So the moment you do that, then Anderson's abilities are slightly different from what we've seen before. So it does sort of push these characters a little bit in ways that I think people might have been not expecting.
Just thinking back to the Judge Child, do you think there's a reason why that kind of episodic epic to a certain extent fell out of fashion? Obviously, you know, it's John and Alan who were driving Dredd after that point. But, you know, you've got the Cursed Earth. Well, you've got Luna One. You've got the Cursed Earth. You've got the Judge Child. And everything after that is much more kind of single story based. You've not got that epic. Do you think there's a reason, then, pure speculation, why John and Alan might have preferred not to kind of repeat that?
No, I mean, it's kind of like it's where they came from, right? I mean, I forget. I think we talked about this maybe when I was on talking about Strontium Dog at Christmas. And when you read those first Stront stories, and you do, it's really writ large, the fact that it's end on a cliffhanger and they don't necessarily know what's coming next week themselves, right? You know, and John says in the recent America collection, which I have up there, America Uncovered, you know, he talks in that about the fact that he doesn't necessarily, he's a writer who often doesn't necessarily like to plan out the entire story, you know, and I think you can see that. I mean, they're so good, John and Alan, and they're so skilled at doing that, that you can see in Judge Child, you know, I it feels like it's, you know, see you next week, viewers. And then they're not entirely sure perhaps where they're going to be next week. I think that's part of the energy of what they brought, but it's the nature of what weekly comics were like when 2000 AD started out. And maybe I think now these days you have a bunch of writers who are kind of schooled on, you know, you've got to have the entire thing worked out before you even start scripting it. It's just a different approach, really, you know, but I mean, I don't know. You'd have to talk to John, but I suspect John probably still works like that today, to be honest with you. I think there's an element of make it up as you go at times. I'm sure he's got, don't get me wrong, I'm sure he's got loads of things. He knows that's happening and he knows that's happening. But that's part of the energy they bring to these things.
Talk a bit about your process on something like this then. You know, if it's a case of having to plan things a bit more in advance than necessarily John and Alan did, or something like the Judge Child, do you start from the end? Do you map it all out? Do you feel your way through it?
There's certain things. I mean, with this, it was a case of sort of trying to... I probably stayed too long in the Arctic section, probably, and then I knew there was a certain, you know, I by the nature of, there was four horsemen, so you just structure the story right, that, you know, we need to deal with all of these along the way, and then we need our big finale. And you know, I kind of knew what the finale was going to be, and I knew I wanted this big cosmic apocalyptic gunfight at the end of the world between Dredd and Ichabod, was, you know. But then there are things along the way where you always, I leave myself a certain amount of free reign of, I don't know everything that's happening. You know, I don't know every single beat. I know certain beats that I'm going to hit. And some things will suggest themselves along the way. But it's just sort of act structure more than anything else, you know. But it's usually I think with Small House and with this, I go back to Matt Smith at the end and just go, can I have a few extra pages for the last episode, Matt? Because as well as I've planned this out, I might have left myself too much to do in the last episode. And unfortunately, with Small House and with this, Matt was like, yes. Probably an unenthusiastic yes, but nonetheless, a yes. And gave me a few extra pages, which you need, you know. I find these days, whatever I'm writing, I'll write the final act before, if I can, before other things, because you want those beats to land, and you don't want to, if you're going to have to sacrifice space somewhere along the line, you don't want to do it at the end. You want the end beats to be well-paced and strong. Ideally, you want it all to be well-paced and strong. But I think the nature of sometimes you have to nip and tuck from certain places. But I really always want the end beats to be really sort of strong and well-paced.
So tell us a bit about the kind of inspiration beyond the Judge show. Because obviously this is... Judge Dredd versus the Horseman of the Apocalypse. Now, when the story was announced, I saw lots of people going, oh, it's the Dark Judges, because, you know, they've always been taken to be the analogy of the Four Horsemen. So I wondered how you look to make sure that you put enough distance between the Dark Judges and this.
Well, there was two ways to do it. There was one was like, we're going to design these new four horsemen and they're going to be new characters. But by the nature of the Dark Judges, they would instantly be, you know, they would be compared to the Dark Judges and probably fail by comparison, because you've got four absolute classic designs and everyone knows them. And Brian Bolland was involved. I don't know if you've heard of him. Are you aware of a Brian Bolland? Little known artist. I think when I was talking with Matt Smith about End of Days, Matt said there was a, what about an approach, but they kind of, or it might be me, I forget, but they kind of, these four horsemen sort of possess certain people basically, and they become certain people. And I like the idea of like, basically through this, it's the end of the world, but there's not some supernatural, we're going to come and we're going to end the world. It was just like the general idea with Dredd's world is the fact that it's completely screwed as we know. It is the end of the world. It was the end of the world a long time ago with Dredd's world. And that's through human actions, you know. So the four horsemen would possess people who effectively had got their world sort of that close to the edge, and the four horsemen would come along and just do the last push, but all the hard work can be done by the human people they were possessing. So that's why you had in Britsit, you've got a scientist who's basically been trying to find a way to do away with feeding poor people by giving them a drug, basically. A sort of little bit of a austerity satire there, Michael. And then in the Arctic one was someone who's been working on a plague, which was interesting timing, because it was like that was all written before we ended up in pandemic. And it was like, do people really want to read a story about a plague that's going to end the world just as we were actually dealing with that over time? And then war, we went to sort of Sov and what had happened to sort of, you know, the Sov cities. So yeah, these are all, it was just sort of not having the big character who's going, the big, you know, pretentious villain basically going, I am the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, which would be terrible grammar anyway, because you can't have, I am the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, make no sense. It was just trying to do it in a slightly sort of different, vaguely interesting way, really. Vaguely interesting is my catchword.
Really, really selling it with that.
Exactly. Yeah. You can put that on the cover if you want.
I mean, you've mentioned various analogies there, and with Ichabod Israel, which was a meta narrative, if there was ever one, is there a danger of disappearing at one's own firmament?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Of course. No. Well, not so much with this, I think. I mean, I hope not, because I think, you know, you want the characters to sort of have a kind of agency and sort of, you know, a life of their own. And I mean, Ichabod was in the initial story, there was a meta narrator, and then it did go very up its backside because the narrator ended up being a character in the final series. Mike Dowling, who drew the narrator to look like me as well, which he didn't tell me he was going to do. But, you know, so if anything's guilty of disappearing up your own firmament, it's the third book of Ichabod Azrael, right? But no, this is much more intended to be just like a gung-ho, dread, you know, cursed earth, Judge Child, you know, road trip across Dread's world where the world has to be saved. But then, you know, along the way, you get some weird characters turn up, which, you know, and again, that's the surprise for me, I suppose. The Russian, I've forgotten his name, a Russian sort of child scientist who Dread encounters was like not in the plan. That's one thing I like about writing. That character was not in the plan going in. I just needed someone when Dread got to Sov territory and introduced him. And it was just like, oh, he's great. I mean, and then Henry Flint drew him to look really weird and freaky. And it was just like, so I was kind of feeling like he kind of popped off the page anyway, which I didn't expect. I mean, when the pages turned up from Henry, it was like, well, I think we'll see him again. So, you know, sometimes you get happy surprises as you go.
You've got the artist change about halfway through from Colin to Henry. Was that intentional?
No, it was, I forget now. It was, I think we talked about Henry drawing it all, and then Henry wasn't available, and then Colin was going to draw it. And then Colin, I was told, I think could do 5, if I remember right. And then Henry was available to come on. So it was, I mean, I think there's a great history of, you know, Dread epics. You know, it's kind of like the visual idiom of Dread epics where, apart from Apocalypse War, really, you know, it's a different artist from one chapter to the next. So, yeah, and I got to work with Colin, who I'd never worked with before. And, you know, Colin's one of the classic sort of Dread artists as far as, you know, the history of the strip. So, yeah, it was a thrill, actually. And then Henry and I have worked together like on a bunch of different Dreads now over the years. Small House being most recent, that we did Titan before that. And, you know, you give Henry anything to draw and he'll just, you know, make it sing, basically. Whether it's small personal beats, whether it's huge cosmic nonsense, it's just Henry does wonders.
Yeah, I do wonder, you know, in a different universe where Colin did the whole thing, how he would have, you know, what he would have brought to those, you know, weird characters that Henry did.
It's I mean, it's kind of weird. I find that, I mean, it's weird. I've been rereading ABC Warriors this week. And it is kind of funny to see with that, where you get like, you know, you get Mick McMahon one week and then you get Brendan McCarthy and then you get Kev O'Neill and then you get Dave Gibbons. And it's just like, it's part of how 2000 AD always sort of rolled, really, you know. And it never seems to miss a beat. I mean, I know we've probably talked about this before, but just like, I find it fascinating with so many people have drawn Dread over the years in so many different ways. And it just, I think we all kind of accept it, really.
It was something that Carlos said about Dread and Strontium Dog and El Mestizo and all those characters that, you know, he for him, Dread was, you know, one of his favorite characters, you know, one of his greatest creations. But for him, Strontium Dog, Johnny Alpha, was his son. Because, you know, he had such a consistency drawing that thing. Whereas, you know, you think, well, if things had worked out differently and Carlos had been the only artist on Dread,
yeah,
how that would have affected the strip's development.
But it's, I mean, even with Stront, I mean, you've got, I mean, I think in the early ones, like Robin Smith drew some, and I think, you know, Brendan draws one, right? And then later on, you've got, I mean, people like Simon Harrison drawing. So it's like, I know there is the, it feels like Carlos is the only person who ever drew Stront ever, but it's not, I mean, it is, you know, he drew the vast bulk of it, don't get me wrong. But I just find it kind of interesting. But other people did draw Stront along the way.
We're going to be talking a lot more about ABC Warriors in a bit, but I wanted to circle back to End of Days because it's a bit of a different flavour to the stuff that you did on The Small House and Titan and even Trifecta with Cy and Al. I just wanted to get an idea of how you see this in your oeuvre, as it were. You know, is this a different stage of you working on Dread, or is it just, you know, you wanted to do something along these lines, so you just did it? And you know,
it's a bit, I mean, it's kind of a little bit sort of, Small House was, you know, whether it achieved this, but was like aiming for a kind of Le Carrier sort of you know, spy espionage type of story within Dread's world. And Titan was, you know, I know it's kind of like a prison drama, but that was essentially me trying to sort of strip Dread, you know, get to the heart of Dread as a man and sort of say things about Dread as a man. And I think sort of like End of Days is, I think approaching it was much more, I know it's apocalyptic and sort of there's some horrible things in it, but it was much more meant to be sort of a fun ride. Do you know what I mean? Just sort of like, it felt like, and you know, there was like, well, if we're going to do the end of the world, well, let's try and do, you know, push it to the end of the world. So it is big. I guess it's, in some ways, it's a bit more, if The Small House was John Le Carrier, I guess this is, End of Days is a bit more Michael Bay, which I'm kind of loath to say, really, because I don't think that's something to necessarily aspire to. But it's going for a broad, fun road trip with just. But then it just kind of goes in sort of some crazy directions. But I mean, I don't think it's got as much to say about Dread as those other ones in terms of sort of like digging down into him, because I think perhaps I'd sort of done that and sort of said, you know, perhaps what I wanted to say there. It's me aiming for that adventure of a week, kind of like, sort of, yeah, much more an adventure, a straight adventure than a sort of contained political intrigue thing. And so it's been, you know, and now it's done. It's, you know, I don't think I'll necessarily do that again. I'll do something else, but I don't know what. But yeah, but it's every time you go into these things, if it is a bigger story, you do think, well, you know, what am I going to do this time that's a bit different from what I did last time? Because otherwise you just end up trying to repeat yourself, really.
One thing that's often discussed is wider impact of a story. And, of course, there's a couple in here. They shoot horses, don't they? And
they shoot talking horses.
Sorry, they shoot talking horses, don't they? Yeah. And carry the nine. I wanted to get your feelings on that, because so often in the retelling, we can create these huge monuments of lingering after effects of epics, which so often are just are not planned, you know, that it's just a callback that makes it feel grounded. So I wanted to get your views on things like the impact of this story and whether you feel that's important for a story to mean something.
Well, I mean, I think that Dredd's perhaps been guilty in the past of like he'll have a big, you know, a big adventure where he'll give a crap knocked out of him, perhaps physically or whatever. And by the nature of 2000 AD, sometimes the next week it'd be another story which you knew had been commissioned, which has nothing whatsoever to do with that story. And it always would jar. It always would felt, you knew you were, you know, you didn't feel like it was quite the same universe. So, I mean, for a while now, we've been doing, it's been, even at the start of Trifecta, you know, where we asked Matt Smith if we could do the first story and then have a couple of weeks to plant the seed and have a couple of weeks grace before the story started. So it didn't have that, you know, stories by different writers and artists, and now our story starts. So hopefully it feels a bit more organic. So, you know, at the back of Small House, I did a one-off called Pets, which kind of slightly dealt with the sort of the after effects. And the same with They Shoot Talking Horses, don't they? Which is a great title. Let's face facts. It's a good title. And I just think of it, I like that it just sort of because these big stories, you know, they do have after effects, whether plot wise or emotionally or physically. So it's nice to kind of give a nod to that, and it just makes the world feel a little more organic, you know. I mean, Carrie the Nine is pretty much a totally different story. I mean, I know it's been included in the collection, which is fine, but again, that's co-written by Arthur Wyatt, I should say, and drawn by Boo Cook. And that is sort of dealing with the accounts judge Maitland. And so there's a little sort of nod back to sort of like Maitland played a part in Enceladus and Titan. And she's been sort of one of the characters I've played with in Dredd's World over the last couple of years. But they had a kind of a little bit of a falling out, shall we say, as Dredd tends to do with people who he works with. But overall, that was just born out of the idea that, you know, an accounts judge could look at the accounts of Mega City One and Justice Department and go, well, hang on, we're spending all this money on fighting crime. What if we shifted some of our money to education instead and tried to stop crime that way? And she finds out, if she does the modeling, and kind of goes, well, we're kind of fighting a never-ending war, which is kind of, we'll never win it, but if we do this, then we possibly could, and we're supposed to be trying to stop crime. This is how we stop crime. But effectively, she has to then go in the room of the Council of Five and tell them this, which is effectively saying, I want to defund the police. And that's going to cause conflict. So it's just, that's an interesting story from that setup, because it just goes to basic things that are going on in our society, in American society now. But again, in terms of the timing, what was weird, all the stuff about defund the police in the States, we wrote that, and then the defund the police stuff started happening, and Arthur was sending me emails going, is our timing a bit off for this? You know, so sometimes it's weird how that happens.
Well, yeah, lovely. I the End of Days book, it's one of those things that sometimes, with any long story, and this applies to the vast majority of the longer stories of Dredd, you can't necessarily get a feel for it on a week-by-week basis. But as soon as it's brought together, you know, it works a lot better. So it's interesting to see such an expansive, like a wide-ranging story all in one big bite.
And I think, without spoilers, I read a couple of comments at the time when it was kind of going, oh, well, there was a few things, like I dropped in a few plot points and didn't explain them till the end. And a few people, I read a few things where people, that it's interesting, the sort of the stamina of reading a story of that length as well. A lot of people expected, I think, some people expected answers to certain questions to be revealed straight away, as opposed to, well, it is okay to just leave a mystery unexplained, and we will explain it eventually. So having it all in one collection, it just gets its own pacing, I guess.
Brilliant. Well, looking forward to having that out in the world. But we also wanted to chat about and do a bit of a deep dive, as you have already said, onto ABC Warriors.
Mm.
Because I noticed you have one of the rather fetching Titan editions.
I got it's eBay treasure occasionally. I can't help it because when I was a teenager, and that advert in the back still fills me with little teenage, ooh, I want those. Even though this eBay treasure got folded at some point in its past, but there you go. I didn't pay much for it, so carry on.
Well, no, I just kind of wanted to embark on that because the ABC Warriors is one of the classic series for 2000 AD. It's part of, I guess, the wider Millsverse. In the over the years, threads have been drawn between it and Invasion and Nemesis and et cetera, et cetera. But I guess in terms of a kind of deep dive, the best place to start is your feelings about coming back to it after all this time, because it is one of those series that, you know, either you read at the time or you caught up on in the best of 2000 AD or graphic novel. And there being a significant gap before revisiting it, sometimes there can be a bit, you know, bit of an emotional whiplash. Sometimes, you know, you discover things that you just would never have encountered before. So I wanted to get, you know, from you what your experience was of hitting this stuff again.
Well, first off, when I was a teenager, it was one of my ABC Warriors, one of my favorite, and that's always been one of my favorites since 2000. And I've read the originals, over the years, but I haven't read them for a long time. I think it's just sort of it's that lightning in a bottle moment, isn't it? It's just, for a start, every week you have Kev O'Neill and you have Mick McMahon, as I said, and you have Brendan McCarthy and you have Dave Gibbons, and it's just, you know, it's one of those moments in time of sort of comics history where it's just sort of, it is a bit sort of, it sounds hyperbolic, but it is a little bit comics-wise, a little bit Beatles-y, you know what I mean? You just kind of, you feel you've got that time and place where it doesn't matter who's drawing it, it's something extraordinary is going on. And then Pat has got, it's just one great character after another gets introduced, basically, week after week. And the structure of the first one, especially, is like, you know, they send Hammersmith off to sort of recruit the team. So you get the sort of, the Mongrel stuff is great. And then all of a sudden Deadlock turns up. And you talk about characters that just immediately go, I want an entire series of this guy. Pretty much the first panel you see him, I think he drives on a sort of like ski motorbike, which is very metal, with a gun on the front. And it's just, yeah, it's just sort of so, such exciting comics. I mean, it's like, I guess it's fairly sort of, it's a war story, obviously. It's the Volgan War. And you have, it's very sort of, you know, cramped by the nature, like, of what the comics were like at the time. And sort of, you know, it feels like you've got about 8 panels on every page and the poor artist is being asked, you know, an army comes over the hill in this panel one, in panel two, we need an establishing shot, in panels, you know, and you can't believe that they do it. And all this amazing robot technology was being drawn and having to be designed. I mean, how they didn't have nervous breakdowns at the time. But it's just fun. It's just really fun comics, you know, and it's just drawn by absolute geniuses.
Well, I mean, you talk about the pace of it there. The very fact that they have such a rotation of artists kind of gives you an indication of how intense it is. Because when I had Kevin Hill on the podcast a few weeks ago, you know, this was the period when I wouldn't necessarily want to say he was at his most productive, but in terms of the sheer amount of work he was doing, and of the quality.
Yeah.
Never mind the stuff that Mick was doing or anybody else. It's absolutely incredible. And the thing that surprises me the most about ABC Warriors is how fundamentally it is part of Pat's oeuvre, you know, it's one of his classic stories. And yet, as Kev said, you know, Pat was dead set against having robot stories.
Right. Okay.
When they started 2000 AD, because, you know, for him, it evoked Asimov, basically. And that kind of, to him, slightly unexciting kind of cerebral sci-fi as opposed to the explosive stuff. So it's kind of, I mean, it's ironic in an Alanis Morissette kind of way that one of his biggest series ended up being lots of robots. But I think it's you're right, it is lightning in a bottle for that very reason, that, you know, it's not the concept per se that is the explosive thing. It's the ideas that are just constantly chucked at it. And I guess that's what makes that early 2000 AD so exciting.
It's also, I mean, when you were a kid reading it, it's interesting as an adult, but, you know, it's like one page on these early things. They don't just introduce the characters. And this is very true of Dread and everything. They introduce all the weaponry and they have a little, like, the drawings of what the specific gun is called, the specific grenade. And they're all called these outlandish sort of things, as this was the same as Strontium Dog, you know. And when you're a kid, that stuff is manna from heaven, you know. It is like a toy box, you know. But then you've also thematically, you've got, you know, it's not that far removed from Pat's Charlie's War, which is a far, far more serious work by the nature of it. But early doors, you have these sort of posh officers who are watching the ABC Warriors from far, not anywhere near the battlefield, and controlling them, you know, and they don't care, and they're all sort of toffs and sipping champagne while they send these robots off to suffer, you know. So it's kind of, in one sense, it's a toy box, and then the stuff that's going on is absolutely not. And then you've got the episode, I mean, I read the other night, where Blackblood's introduced, you know, where they just wipe out a school, you know, very early on. So it would be easy to make it sort of Rock'em Sock'em Robots or something in some way, but it's you know, it's got that pathos stuff as well. And then you know, you think back to the Martian Blues one-off that Alan Moore wrote, that Steve Dillon and John Higgins did, which is one of the best, saddest little comic stories in 2000 AD's history, you know, which with those characters. So it's just an absolute comics treat, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that whole thing about the officers, you look at Robusters, which is the progenitor of ABC Warriors, and that's all the same kind of notion, but it's capitalism, you know. It's big business, treating sentient robots as expendable. But then once you introduce war, the mm-hmm. notion of, you know, it being robots being used for conflicts, you do plug into that Charlie's War, World War One of lions led by donkeys kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And the robots suffer in it, you know. It's just like, it's not just, you would think there's a, you know, emotional disconnect to get past with that. You think, oh, it's a bunch of robots fighting each other, but they all feel pain. And even Mungrel, the stupidest of them, is sort of loves Lara, you know, and misses Lara, his tragic love who died. So it's got a real kind of, it's got a lot of heart as well, you know. But I one of the most exciting comic things for me in my entire life was when Brian Talbot was drawing Nemesis, and when the ABC Warriors turned up in Nemesis when I was a teenager, I was just like, oh my God, that's like comics nirvana, you know. And again, it's not the same thing, but like with Ichabod Azrael turning up in Judge Dredd, things like that, when you know, if you do it too often, it, you know, it sort of doesn't have the effect. But when something like that, where you kind of go, it feels like sort of larger worlds opening up, is very exciting.
You see, when I read Brian, because Brian's Nemesis was the first Nemesis I ever encountered when it was in Best of 2000 AD. So when the ABC Warriors turned up, I had no clue who they are. I had no clue who they were. But I think at roughly the same time, on the back cover, I think maybe Robin Smith had done like a multi-part poster, and one of the parts was the robots of 2000 AD, and it had Call Me Kenneth and Walter and Mr. 10%. Even like the was it the Terramex, the little round-headed things from Robo Hunter. And that was, I think I've mentioned that before on the podcast, but that was incredibly evocative. When you don't know what these things are, when you don't necessarily have that backstory, they become playgrounds for your imagination. And that's one thing that I will always like about ABC Warriors is even when it's been at its most polemical, when it's been at its most didactic, it's still got enough detail there and enough ideas behind it to, you know, inspire your own imagination in a way that an awful lot of comics just, you know, they tell you everything you need to know and thanks very much indeed, and now we're at the end kind of thing. But 2008 has always had that thing of not just giving you the story in front of you, but inspiring your own in your head, as it were, you know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think I have a vague memory of like when me and my friends used to do role playing when we were teenagers. We used to, I forget which game it was. I think we might have written the ABC Warriors into the game at some point, you know, don't sue us, Rebellion. But it was already done on pieces of paper. But yeah, it was, they're just amazing designs. And I think that's the thing in the early one as well, you know, Blackbird, just, you know, you get Deadlock turns up and you get Mongrel and then you get Blackblood turns up and then Steelhorn, who isn't quite as interesting, but it's just like it just hits, you know. And then that's even before Mechquick turned up way down the line, who's might, you know, has a certain simplistic charm about him. Joe Pineapples, you mentioned, Garth Ennis seems to be obsessed with Joe Pineapples wearing a dress in that one episode. It's been fun to reread it, really. And I bought the Nemesis, don't tell anyone, the Titan reprints as well. I'm going to work my way through them next, I think.
And with the ABC Warriors, is there is it something that works from the off? Because I guess to a certain extent, it had gone through Robusters already. You know, they'd already established Rogers and Roger. Rogers and Hammerstein as the kind of key protagonists. But then, you know, you open it up to all these other team members who all bring their own particular thing. And you're right, that is the right phrase. It's a toy box.
Mm.
You know, all of a sudden your imagination's got all these fantastic things to play with. And all of them are so, with the exception of perhaps Steelhorn, all of them are so unique that your childhood imagination can immediately grasp.
Well, I think it's kind of like there is a kind of, yeah, right, thrill power, right? So there is a weekly, it's a kid's comic. I mean, obviously they were pushing crazy boundaries, but at that point that's what it is by definition, I suppose. So there is that sense of, if you are going to have a character, you make it bombastic and over the top. And if you're going to have the weapons, you give them names and like, you know, they could have easily been and probably should have been ABC Warriors, you know, toys and things like this. I'm sure kids would have loved them at the time, however, back in those days. But it's got that sensibility, but then you've just got some, you know, plainly some very smart, talented people behind it as well, who are, you know, can't help themselves probably, but tell a story which does have pathos and you know, the horrors of war and all those kind of things sort of writ large. But again, I forgot that Robusters was before it, right? So just the fact that Hammerstein had an entirely different head for two different stories is a really weird design choice, right? I mean, it's great. I love it. But that was my that's my old other head, which looks completely. You're changing the very nature of a look of a character, which is kind of odd. But anyway.
But then, of course, incorporating that change into the narrative.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, again, just kind of opens it up. I love what Kevin Neill was saying about designing Rojaws, about how he just kind of evolved as in terms of his look, but the thing that he's meant to be isn't, like, he's not practical for the thing that he's meant to be.
Right.
Like, he can't bend down and pick things up. His teeth kind of hinge backwards.
But he's a garbage eater, right? That's what he is.
Yeah. That can't pick things up off the floor
because he's got small arms.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, I mean, but it's interesting. I mean, like, when Deadlock turns up, you immediately, like I said, you immediately go, I want to know a lot more about this character. This character completely pops. I'd be curious, I've never read up on this, to know, was there the intention to make it part of Nemesis's universe? Was that there at the time, or just as, is it just the fact that Kev draws Deadlock to look like he could very, very easily be Nemesis? You know what I mean? It's like, it's probably that, isn't it? But, you know, and then the other things followed later on. I don't know. Maybe Pat had a vast notebook filled with all his plans back in those days. I'm not sure.
One of the things I love about Deadlock is that that motorbike, I don't know whether it does this early on, but certainly by the time that Bisley comes along to do the black hole, the front wheel has turned into a chainsaw, which is incredibly cool. You know, just as you say, it's manner.
Subtle. It's subtle.
But my first reaction as a youngster coming to it, we've gone, that would just bite down into the ground. Like, that wouldn't get him anywhere. Like, completely taking it at face value as opposed to, wow, that's so cool. Okay.
I think if we look at much of this stuff practically, it might turn into a naked lunch moment. You don't really want to see what's at the end of the fork, I think, as Mr. Burroughs said. It'll all come. Don't pull that string, for God's sake. I've always, oh, God, what have I done with my life? Yeah, it's... So, spoilers. Is Deadlock Nemesis? I've forgotten. I haven't read that stuff for so long. Is he Nemesis?
Yeah, you've asked me a question I can't answer there because I can't remember. No. No, he's not. No, he can't be. Because at the end, in the final Nemesis story, it's Nemesis and Tokimada looping the black hole.
I need to reread it. It's been a long, long, long time, and I've forgotten the vast majority of it. But I would heartily, heartily recommend that people pick up the early ABC Warriors collection.
Well, thanks very much indeed to Rob for that. Fascinating. It's always great to talk about 2000 AD, whether we're on point or whether we're talking about something in the archives. So, make sure you pick up Just at the End of Days, and also don't forget that early Robusters and ABC Warriors is available from shop.2080.com. Next week, we are back with a nice long chat with Tiernan Trevelyan, who is the artist on, lots of stuff, Tales from the Black Museum, Absalom, and his recent work on Fiends of the Eastern Front was an absolute vote winner for me. So it was wonderful to be able to get him online and chatting away. He's not a big fan of interviews, but we do delve into his inspiration behind his artwork, what he hopes to achieve with it, what his aim in his career is. So it was a real pleasure to be able to chat to Tiernan about his work and life. So we shall see you in 7 days' time for that. And until then, Earthlets, keep keeping safe and Splendid Vertwig.
Fill power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! the 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com.